Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Steve Clemens, who's a senior fellow and director of the American Strategy Program at the New America Foundation. And Steve Clemens is also does the popular blog The Washington Note, which has recently revealed evidence of a split in the administration between the vice president's faction, the so-called neoconservatives, and another group, which I suppose you could call the neo-pragmatists, Condoleezza Rice, Robert Gates, General Hayden, and others, in a contest for the direction of American foreign policy. In particular, Dick Cheney, according to Steve Clemens, is undermining the diplomatic track while ensuring the military option against Iran. And we'll speak also with Robert Fisk. We'll go to Beirut. He's the best-selling author and acclaimed journalist who's based in Beirut, Lebanon. He's a Middle East correspondent for The Independent. He's lived in that region for almost three decades. And we'll be talking to him about the Palestinian refugee camp that's surrounded, besieged by the Lebanese army, who have created a number of civilian casualties in their hunt for this obscure, supposedly al-Qaeda allied faction of Palestinians, if indeed they are Palestinians. So we'll be talking about the extent to which Lebanon is poised on the brink, as the king of Jordan last year said that there could be three civil wars in the region in 2007, one, of course, in Iraq, two in Lebanon, and three in Palestine. So at least the first one's for real, the second one's a possibility. So is the third, for that matter. And we'll also speak with Tyson Slocum, who's the director of Public Citizens Energy Program. And he testified this week before the United States House Committee on Energy and Commerce, the Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations. And, of course, he testified on gasoline prices, oil company profits, and the American consumer. So we'll be talking to him about the rising price of gasoline and the shrinkage in the refining capacity and the extent to which there's some gaming going on, reminiscent of what happened here in California in 2000 with the electricity market. I'm now speaking with Steve Clemens, who is a senior fellow and director of the American Strategy Program at the New America Foundation. He's also responsible for the popular blog, The Washington Note. And recently in The Washington Note, Steve Clemens, you've been talking about how the Cheney faction, if you will, the neoconservatives, are at war with the neo-realists or pragmatists, Condoleezza Rice, Robert Gates, General Hayden, I guess Negroponte's, and McConnell is also in that group. And the extent to which Dick Cheney is undermining the diplomatic track while ensuring the military option. Is this, when do you expect everybody's sort of suggesting that how could you have another war? We've already got our hands full in Iraq. What are they smoking in the vice president's office?
Well, you know, it's a great question, Ian. I just want to congratulate you on a really magnificent program on Memorial Day. But I think the question of rationality and war and the kind of empirical evidence that we've got an overstretched military, that we've bogged down in certain places, and that, you know, how in the world could someone be trying on top of all of this to, broaden and extend our commitments even further, is a great question to ask. But I think those critics of the war from the very, very beginning, and I was one of these critics of those who wanted to invade Iraq, basically said that, you know, America as a superpower is more mystique than real to begin with, and that rationally you could really undermine your interests enormously if you showed your limits as a great nation, because then your allies aren't going to count on you as much, your enemies are going to move their agendas. So there's never been a struggle between rationality. It's just you have a group of people, and they're around Vice President Cheney, who think that we ought not to be kind of soberly counting costs and benefits. And we've great moral objectives in the world, and we need to pursue those regardless of costs. And I think it's crazy, but I do think that this is a very real problem today.
Well, given that that we're asking the Iraqi government to meet the benchmarks, this comes with the signing of the with Bush signing the last supplemental, which was held up a little bit by the Congress and now released. And I've always resisted this idea that it's all about oil, but. Is it possible that this was a sort of an oil grab that Dick Cheney and his friends from Houston thought they could get away with, and now they're mad that the Iranians have basically ended up with the prize?
I think that, you know, those people who used to joke around that we fought the Cold War in Japan won, and now there's these people joking that either we fought the global war on terror and either China has won or Iran has won. But in many ways, the mullahs in Iran and the theocracy there, for many of the neoconservatives, particularly Michael Ledeen and others, was always the first target. And that if the price of getting to that first target, which was Iran and its terrorist activity, as they described it, was there, if the price of that was invading Iraq and marshaling U.S. forces in the region, then that was fine by them. And then, you know, let's go ahead and invade Iraq. I just don't think they ever saw the downsides or the potential that we might not do as well as we have. So whether it's oil or not, I think, is not the big question. The big question is, as I wrote the other day, is Dick Cheney could be part of a good cop, bad cop strategy that Bush is deploying. What was shocking to me about what I wrote the other day was that one of Dick Cheney's chief lieutenants is out denigrating Bush himself and thinking that the president may make the wrong policy decision and go down the wrong course, and that Cheney, therefore, thus needed to try to engineer something that would tie the president's hands and constrain his choices. This is incredible insubordination and shows the level of tension inside the White House. So whether it's oil or not, or what the rational agenda might be that you might ascribe to these people, that's one important part of the story. The bigger part of the story, though, is that if Cheney's people, if not Cheney himself, are out, you know, part of their title is Special Assistant to the President of the United States, and if they are, in fact, trying to undermine or constrain the choices that President Bush has before him, I look at that as I would assume it's criminal at some level. But on the other hand, I would assume that the President of the United States ought to do something about it.
Well, then, let's not speculate any further about what the motives are and concentrate on the machinations going on here within the White House and the extent to which this is a usurpation of power. Now, clearly, the vice president has essentially had the president all to himself. He's the last person he always talks to before a decision is made. Many people think he's the chief operating officer, and while the president is the chief executive officer who sort of takes care of the shareholders and makes speeches. But the real reins and hands-on activity is Dick Cheney. So is Dick Cheney now? I mean, obviously the father wanted some other people in there, and he managed to get this. It seems it managed to get Gates in there. So is this what's going on, that there are other people now that Bush is listening to, and that Cheney's basically trying to recapture his monopoly on the president's attention?
I think that's exactly it. And you know, there are people like Joe Klein of Time Magazine and some folks at Harper's and others that have been linking to the blog post and adding other dimensions to the story. And the general line is that Cheney believes, according to the senior national security aide, he's only got three, so it's easy to guess who it is. Mm-hmm. The line is that Cheney says that Bush can no longer be counted on to make the right policy decision on Iran. That the combination of Bob Gates coming in at Department of Defense, Condi Rice and Nick Burns and John Negroponte's efforts on the diplomatic front, and more importantly, which I didn't add in the blog, but it is an important piece of this, Joshua Bolton's management inside the White House has tacked the president away from the kind of mindset and template for war that Iran had. That doesn't mean that war and conflict are off the table, but it does mean that Cheney no longer believes that they'll win the policy battle. And what was disconcerting about this is that Cheney felt that what you needed to do in this case was try and nudge Israel forward, get Israel to engage in a low-level, single-strike, a small-scale conventional cruise missile attack on Natanz, the nuclear reactor in Natanz, not designed to wipe out, you know, Iran's nuclear capacity, but very designed to try to provoke a reaction from Iran against U.S. forces in the region. And that in that circumstance, the president would not be able to have the latitude to pursue the course that these other people are pursuing. This is fairly ominous because it is what this individual called an end-run strategy, an end-run not around Condi and around Josh Bolton and around all these other guys, around Bush himself if they lost the policy battle with the president. That is you know, incredibly shocking. Now, one question is, would Israel do this? I don't know. I have my doubts. The Vinograd report shows that Elliot Abrams and others tried to encourage Israel to expand its theater of operations to Syria, and both Olmert and Livni said clearly no. So we shouldn't just assume that because Cheney's people are talking about it that it's automatic. But it does give us some insight to huge tension in the White House and the fact that the vice president, perhaps, but at least the vice president's staff, is engaged in what I think is possibly criminally insubordinate behavior. So it ought to worry us all.
So he's basically trying to gin up a war to lock the president in and do an end run around any kind of moderation of his policy.
That's right, to keep
the
president from being able to tack towards the people that have come in. So, yes, your question was, is he listening to other people? Very clearly he is, and the president and Cheney's upset about it.
Right, and Cheney sort of runs, first he's the only vice president to have a his own National Security Council staff is larger than Jack Kennedy's was. And
oh, it's much larger. You know, the other thing I think we talked about on the show a long time ago when the president and vice president began talking about their ability to declassify documents at will. Remember the case where the president leaked out a national intelligence estimate, people saying, how can this happen? What's the process of declassification? And when you went back to look at the legal changes in the law under this presidency, the office of the vice president as an institution has been written into executive statutes in ways that we've never seen in our history. And the office of vice president has, you know, we keep talking about the massive expansion of presidential authority, but we've also had a massive expansion of vice presidential authority in this era that we're going to be dealing with for a long time.
And he also has a sort of adjunct, if you will, NSC over at the American Enterprise Institute, which, you know, his wife, Lynn, is essentially the den mother over there. And that's where many of the neoconservatives, the people, in fact, the architects of the surge, are located.
Well, that's right. And there are other people over there that are architects of the surge. There's John Bolton over at AEI. There are a good number of folks at AEI, and AEI acts as the external chief ideology operation for the Cheney wing of the U.S. foreign policy establishment. And thus they can't be ignored. This isn't conspiracy theory. A lot of people said this is really deep conspiracy theory. It is not. If you've got someone who in multiple forums has been basically denigrating the president and saying, we can't count on the president because he's taking a course that we don't agree with. And because we don't agree with that, we need to take extraordinary measures to try to tie the president's hands. So it's not just, you know, a neoconservative operation that is, you know, soft and fuzzy and intellectual and people kind of trying to get op-ed placement. These are people that really are playing for keeps and, in my view, are responsible for a lot of deaths and responsible for a lot of the mess the United States is in today. And I think it's very important for us now that when we see things going on like we saw in this Cheney commentary, it's been 3 weeks I've been working on this story, is very, very important for people to come out and blow the whistle when they see it, to surface it, bring it to the forefront so that the people know what's going on.
There's a quote here from the former U.S. ambassador to Israel, and he was also the Assistant Secretary of State for Near East Affairs of the Clinton administration, Martin Indyk. Talking about Cheney, I think they saw the multilateral negotiations as a banana peel for Condoleezza Rice. If you really believe the military option is the only way to go, then you need to lay the predicate for it. And the best predicate is that we tried the diplomatic route and it didn't work.
That's right. And they believe that you try the diplomatic route as a charade, mm-hmm. as a precursor and predicate to military action, even though they never believed it, so it was not credible. their worry is that Rice and Gates actually do believe in the diplomatic track, that they can set up a set of incentives and disincentives for Iran that will matter, and that the president himself has opted against this. And I encourage people to look at, you know, Joe Klein's not everybody's favorite person on the left, but look at what he wrote about Cheney and Bush this last year in his own blog. I think it's called Swampland. And Joe validates a very important part of this, that the president, after a key meeting in the Situation Room, or what they call the tank, essentially decided that option A, which is Cheney approach of brute force bombing and trying to do a surgical strike against Iran's nuclear capacities, was no longer a real option, and thus tacked towards team, you know, option B. And Klein's point is, it seems clear that on a number of fronts that Cheney is working at counterpoint to sort of make option A work, and has never signed on to where the president is. That's a really remarkable statement.
But Steve Clements, it seems that there's some resistance from an unusual quarter here. And when Admiral Fallon was appointed to CENTCOM, there was a lot of speculation that that was making a Navy airstrike more likely, since he was a Navy aviator. And
right.
In fact, I think I was guilty of assuming that as well. But he apparently has been dead against this attack on Iran.
Admiral Fallon is one of the great heroes of the day. He essentially, when he came in, just before he was CENTCOM commander, so he was sort of the CENTCOM commander nominee, if you were, not fully appointed but on his way, the White House pressured him strongly to make an official request of the president to deploy a third carrier strike force group. And Fallon strongly resisted and rejected that. And they were at a position at that point where they could not step back with their appointment of him. The appointment went on through. And Fallon basically said, that's not where we're going, because he knew that what was happening was that that kind of buildup could easily be exploited by someone who would light a match or create a triggering incident, much like Cheney's people have been talking about. And Fallon is a great hero because, to some, in my mind, he's a great hero because he's basically playing very shrewd with these politicos on the other side in ways that I think the military leadership has not until recently. And I think even Petraeus and others are now hedging their bets in a different way than they were before, where they were just basically flax for whatever the White House wanted, and they would basically cover up all of the bad decisions and missteps that the whites had done, and, you know, call something that was white, black, you know, basically depending on what political cues they got. Fallon is turning out to be a very different character, and I think is sensible and frankly sane. It doesn't mean you and I will agree with every decision he makes, but frankly, that decision not to allow the president to get away with a carrier strike force group, it's kind of like, you know, it was John Ashcroft who said no on the wireless wiretaps. I was, you know, shocked mm-hmm. about that, too. So we may have to go back someday and kind of pull out the, you know, old Barry Goldwater line of conscience of a conservative awards and figure out who we need to, you know, to basically thank, at least in small part, for not, you know, not getting a worse situation today.
Well, just in closing there, Steve Clements, there's been some speculation that the surge, in fact, was the subtext of the surge was to secure, not so much to secure Baghdad, but to secure the Iranian surrogates, like the extent to which the Mahdi army and others might react if the United States attacked Iran. So is there anything to that?
Well, I think that in part the surge and the surge strategy, as we heard both in January, the president gave both the State of the Union address and he gave his address to the nation in reaction really to the Iraq study group. In both cases, he tried to make the case for the surge, and in both cases, he basically told Syria and Iran that we're coming after you, we might do cross-border action, and we're going to shut down your options, you know, operations inside Iraq. So it was, for all these people that are talking about covert action being authorized and a finding being established by the president for covert action against Syria and Iran, it happened in January of this year. And, you know, the news, you know, we reported back then, I think I had a talk with you, orchestrated by your great producer, Louis Vandenberg, and we you know, we're on top of that. And now it looks as if there's been some backing off that strategy, which was essentially to engage in regime change antics back then. But I think that the surge has always been more about Iran and Syria than it has ever been about Baghdad. And I think that, and even that has not worked. So we really need to take a step back and look broadly at the whole set of policy tools that the Cheney team helped sculpt and how incredibly ineffectual and counterproductive they've been. I think that there's a new group in place. I don't want to overstate the possibilities of success because things are so crappy now. It's very hard to pull a rabbit out of this hat. But I do think that the more the Cheney team is isolated and has their, you know, their legs chopped off to some degree in what they're able to do in the policy world, the healthier the whole situation will be.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Steve Clemons.
Great to be with you, Ian. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking there with Steve Clemons, who's a senior fellow and director of the American Strategy Program at the New America Foundation, and he has a very popular blog, The Washington Note, where you can get further details on his belief and the research that Dick Cheney is trying to undermine the diplomatic track with Iran to ensure the military option. I'm now switching to Beirut to speak with Robert Fisk, who's a best-selling author and acclaimed journalist. He's based in Beirut, Lebanon. He writes for the Independent, and he's lived in the region for almost three decades. And I've just been reading your dispatches here, Robert, of going to the hospitals and witnessing the victims of the bombardment of the Palestinian camps, and it's quite heartbreaking. Do you have a real handle on who this group is, this new so-called...
How very American of you to say, do I have a handle on...
Well, yeah, I'm guilty of having lived here a long time, Robert. I mean...
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, forgive me, the phrase handle on is sort of CNN Fox. Look, this organization has been around since last summer. It first emerged in Lebanon, Fatah al-Islam, struggle of Islam, during the Hezbollah-Israeli war, when all our attention was on the massive Israeli bombardment of Lebanon in response to the capture of two of their soldiers across the border. We didn't keep our eye on the ball, as usual, as journalists, nor did anyone else, especially Americans. And 200 to 300, maybe 700, it's pick and take, fighters from Yemen, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, including Lebanese themselves and Palestinians, came into Lebanon and founded this organization in Nahr al-Barad, which is, means a cold river. It's a Palestinian refugee camp far to the north of Lebanon, more than 100 kilometers from the border of Palestine or Israel, whatever you like to call it. And I actually went up to interview them and thought they were so boring I didn't even report it. That shows how bad a reporter I am or how how poor they were in getting their message across. Run by a guy who supposedly and possibly truly is responsible for the murder of a U.S. diplomat in Jordan, Lawrence Sully. Good man, not in any way a sort of CIA agent, but a person involved in great concern for the American side, empathy side for Palestinians and Jordanians. Either way, he was imprisoned in Syria, released, sent here, and these people built up around him. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, didn't it all begin with a bank robbery?
Well, was it a bank robbery? You see, here we go. The bank that was robbed was owned by the Hariri family. That's the same family as Rafik Hariri, who, of course, was the former prime minister, murdered more than 2 years ago here in Beirut. Most people in Lebanon think that the Syrians were involved. And, indeed, his son, Saad, is now in the government. The tribunal, which is supposed to be UN tribunal, which is supposed to judge those guilty of his murder, and who may well find Syrians guilty, is now stymied because on the one hand, the parliament here can't meet for reasons which are for domestic politics I won't bore you with, and internationally, the UN doesn't want to create under Chapter 7 because it doesn't want to upset the Russians, it doesn't want to upset the Chinese, here's another Middle East factor. The UN tribunal is a key to this issue, but what happened at the weekend was that a number of armed men went to a Hariri bank in northern Lebanon and tried to steal, and successfully did steal, $150,000. Not a huge heist, as you know, bank robberies go, but there you go. They then deliberately hid out in apartments in the center of the northern Lebanese city of Tripoli, in the wealthiest area. I mean, you're talking in Lebanese terms of, you know, $250,000 an apartment. I got up there. I was here on Sunday. I drove frantically up the main highway to Tripoli and got into this area. It's called 200 Street, Mi'atain, Shaya Mi'atain in Arabic. And as the army were about to storm into the building, and what was extraordinary, I went with the army. They let me go with them. And we went up the staircase, and they went up shooting. And these guys fought to the death. They didn't want to surrender. One guy was shot in the stomach in front of me. He fell backwards through a window 16 floors down into a burning parking lot. Another guy was wounded, lying on the ground, dying, and he tried to put a new ammunition clip into his gun. And in front of me, a soldier threw a hand grenade at him and blew his arm off and killed him. This was a terrible day. Sunday was an awful, awful day, I have to tell you. Terrible day. But these guys fought to the death, so they're very serious people. And they then retreated, those that were survived, into the Nahal Barat camp, which is the Kol River refugee camp. And the army then shelled that camp mercilessly, because most of the soldiers had been killed, 26 that day, had been killed in cold blood, and they were from the north of Lebanon. Their families were outraged, they wanted revenge, and they poured shell fire into the camp and killed lots of children, civilians, women, I'm sorry to say. True.
And some of the Lebanese soldiers had their heads chopped off, didn't they?
Well, what happened was that there was a military position outside the camp under the agreements between the Palestinians. I mean, forget Islam, between the Palestinian organizations and the Lebanese government. The Palestinians govern the camps and maintain security, and the Lebanese around the outside. The Lebanese army had grown used to the habit of just, you know, guarding as a kind of folkloric way of looking after it. They didn't care much. They knew the Palestinians would obey the rules, but of course in these cases they didn't. Four soldiers were on duty on the Saturday night, and when Fatah al-Islam fighters came out, they cut their throats and chopped their heads off and put their heads on the position. They then went into a small barracks where 16 other soldiers were sleeping. I have their names. I spoke to their colleagues actually today, a few hours ago. And they went round, they were all asleep, and they went round one by one firing bullets into their heads. They executed them all. It was the most brutal, cruel killing. And of course, naturally enough, mostly soldiers came from the north of Lebanon. It's an area which is well known for its traditions of taking family revenge. The families wanted to exact punishment for the killing of their sons and husbands and lovers. Of course they did. Mm-hmm. And so one of the great dangers immediately was that the army would be let loose on the camps, which they were. And in the initial 24 hours, many children, women, civilians, old men, and of course men of fighting age were killed. I saw them in the hospital. Terrible scenes. Mm-hmm. But it now appears that a new unit, well, I know the unit involved of the Lebanese army has been put in charge, and I know one of the former intelligence officers, and that this wild fire onto the camps has ended. So that now there is a form of discipline, and of course people are now talking, can we have some kind of dialogue in which, you know, the Lebanese members of this organization can be submitted to Lebanese justice and the foreigners can be handed over to other justice. And there's a big problem because, you see, on the one hand, the Lebanese army, which in the north is basically northern Lebanese army, I mean, they are local people, want to see justice done. They don't see why their brothers and fathers should have their heads chopped off and the killers get away with it.
Well, also
on the other hand, in the nation of Lebanon, you know, there are other issues like, you know, do you carry this through as a series of revenge killings, or do you accept that there has to be a political solution? Mm.
Well, you mentioned though in your the dispatches, if you will, that when you went to the hospitals, you also interviewed some victims of the Fatah al-Islam, and they were shot within the camp because they were with the PLO.
Yep, Absolutely. There was a very interesting moment. I was going through the hospital and being accosted by Palestinians who wanted to say how Fatah al-Islam had treated them fairly and rightly and they were okay. And then this man came out to me and grabbed me by the sleeve. He said, Mr., please, Mr. Robert, come with me. I do a lot of Lebanese TV, so people know me. So he recognized me and he pulled me into the side room. And there was this very handsome young man lying on a bed with tattoos, lots of tattoos. One had a tattoo of a snake going up his arm, but he was a former Fatah, not Fatah al-Islam, but Fatah, i.e. PLO, Arafat man. And he was lying on a bed, he couldn't speak, and he was half paralyzed. And his father said to me, my son, this is the young man, he said he came here on the 3rd of May, this is long before the chaos which we've now experienced. And two Fatah al-Islam men came to him and his two friends. They killed his two friends and tried to kill him because they were opposed to them ideologically. Now, this guy lived in the center of the camp, not on the edge of the camp, which means that Fatah al-Islam was in the center of Nahr al-Bared, and the Palestinians let them get in. Now, you can turn around and say, well, hold on a second, they should never have allowed that. But then again, if you're a Palestinian and you've lost your homeland and the Lebanese don't care much about you, why should you shoot or kill these people who are also your fellow Muslims? You see, you can follow it through that way.
Right.
But this guy, anyway, was shot and was clearly shot as I pushed and pushed and pushed at the father. As the young man looked and blinked at me, I don't know how much of this he understood. I think he understood it all, but I think he certainly couldn't express himself. He was half paralyzed. And the father said, ideologically they disagreed, and they wanted to kill him. And he said, Fatah al-Islam is a terrorist organization, and they want to destroy us as Palestinians. So when I heard this, I put this into my story as part of the story of the tragedy. You know, you can't, because you have someone pop out of the ground and say Fatah al-Islam is a bad organization, you can't, you know, delete them from the story on the ground that they'll ripple the message you may be giving. Clearly, Fatah al-Islam has been an extremely al-Qaeda-ish Salafist organization in the camp. Not one which I think the Palestinians would find it easy to get rid of, but certainly one which existed there and still exists. And of course, now you've got the situation where do you say, well, you know, oh, well, you've got to get rid of these terrorists. The Americans are flying an air bridge into Beirut at the moment. I was driving past the airport today, and an American C-130 flew over full of ammunition. They want to give ammunition to the Lebanese army. You know, last summer when the Lebanese army was confronted by the Israelis, the Americans wanted the Israelis to win. Now they want the Lebanese to win against their proxy enemies, the Fatah al-Islam. And next year, perhaps, you know, they'll want the Lebanese army to bow down and go on their knees. And the Lebanese are not stupid people. They're not stupid. They understand what's going on. And the Americans' role in this is becoming ever more dubious and doubtful in the eyes of the Lebanese, because, you know, here, first of all, the United States wanted Lebanese democracy. Then when Hezbollah captured two Israeli soldiers and the Israelis started bombing Lebanon, America didn't care about Lebanese democracy, didn't care about the Lebanese army, who died in large numbers. One group of 11 soldiers, I knew three of them, were killed because they were members of a logistics team trying to repair electrical lines in Lebanon, for God's sake. And then suddenly, now the Lebanese army are the heroes of the United States again. The Americans want to give them weapons. It's a preposterous situation. It's getting this sort of accretions of international effects upon it. We are told, I know as a fact, that the Lebanese army were offered Leopard tanks from Belgium. And the Americans vetoed them because they were frightened that the Lebanese might use them against the Israelis. Then they were offered Gazelle helicopters to attack the terrorists, quote, terrorists, unquote, right? And the Gazelle helicopters are here, but they haven't got any rockets. So they can't attack the helicopter. They can't attack the, quote, terrorists, unquote. In other words, they've been furnished with French-built attack helicopters with no method of attack. So what are they supposed to use the helicopters for? Tourism? The Roman ruins of Baalbek, perhaps? I mean, you know, it's a preposterous situation. And in the meantime, the Lebanese army continues to surround the camps in the north, aware of the fact, and this is the key issue, that the Palestinians are allies of the Hezbollah, who are representative, basically, of the largest religious community in Lebanon, the Shiites. If that crack widens, then we have the Sunnis versus the Shiites, and we have another civil war. And no doubt Mr. Bush will see this as part of the war on terror or some other preposterous objective, but that's the problem. So we have war now from the Pakistani border, inside Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Gaza, the West Bank, and Lebanon.
Here
we are in Lebanon. This should not be the case. This should not be happening.
It's exactly what King Abdullah predicted last year, that there'd be three civil wars in the region in 2007. But Robert Fisk, when you talk about, you mentioned the revenge factor, I understand that there isn't a lot of love lost between the Palestinians and the Lebanese in general. That when the PLO was strong there before the 82 invasion, they apparently offended a lot of people. So, and there was evidence of local civilians, Lebanese civilians, firing sniper fire at ambulances as Palestinians were evacuated from the camp. So give us a sense of the animus, if indeed it's
Look, I think you're making mistakes in your historical analysis here. The Civil War undoubtedly is the genesis of a lot of the present concern, suspicion, and violence. But the Civil War is not as simple as you're making it out to be. The Palestinians tried to stay out of the Civil War. They tried to stay away from it. And they were dragged in on the Muslim side, because most Palestinians are Sunni Muslims. But the Palestinians, because they don't have a home here, because, you know, the 300,000 or so Palestinians here are children or grandchildren or the actual people who fled Palestine in 1948, which has become Israel, in the Nakba, and what they call the disaster and what the Israelis call the War of Independence. These people live here. They don't want to live in Lebanon. They prefer to go home, but they can't go home because home is now in what is called Israel. And the Lebanese understand this very well. And so they're trying to juggle with the fact that in their own complex situation, where the majority, not the majority, but the largest community is Shiite, not the majority, but the largest is the difference. If you, for example, turn all the Palestinians into Sunni Muslim Lebanese, if you give them passports, the Sunnis will become the largest community, and then you have the potential for another civil war. So, for a start, you know, there's this whole sectarian issue of whether you regard the Palestinians as your brothers in nationhood, or your brothers in religion, or your brothers in humanity, to slightly misquote the Imam Ali. And you have this terrible situation where now, for example, all kinds of groupuscules, the French say, little groups, can turn up and nurture themselves in Palestinian refugee camps, which are the pits. I mean, you're not talking about tents, you're talking about dirt slums, sewage, garbage, something you would imagine from the Middle Ages. I spent yesterday and the day before yesterday in the worst and largest camp in Lebanon, the most dangerous camp in Lebanon, Ein El Helwe. It's shit, you know? Mm-hmm. They live in these places. They try to keep clean.
Mm-hmm. Well, Robert, do I still have you?
Yes, you do. I just heard your voice cut in on me, yeah?
Yes. Just in closing, then, there's an old adage that to some extent Lebanon is like the Yugoslavia of the Middle East. It's also maybe the Poland of the Middle East.
Is there? You know, they used to describe Yugoslavia as the Lebanon of the Middle East. Now you're describing Lebanon as the Yugoslavia of the Middle East.
Right, but now
Lebanon,
I threw in Poland as well. I mean, what about the notion of any outside meddling in terms of
look, I'm gonna be as brief as I can because I know your time is
right.
More precious than mine. I'm not sure that's true, but anyway, I'm going to pretend it is. here's the situation. Look, Lebanon is made up of many different sects and religions, but these people can get on well, just as blacks and whites can get on in the United States. You draw lots of maps in your newspapers of Shiite areas, Sunni areas, Druze areas. We don't draw lots of maps of black and white areas in Washington, though we could. or we don't draw sectarian maps of New York, though I could for you if you wanted, though you wouldn't print them, right? I think we should stop chopping people up. People in Lebanon want to live, and they're quite happy to live with the Palestinians. But we foreigners, people like you and me, we engender fear in these people. We say, watch out, watch out. The Iranians are coming. They're in the camps. They're in the Palestinians. They're with the Palestinians. They're with the Christians. They're with the Sunnis. You know, I've got a new book out, which came out in the States, and it's out in Arabic in Lebanon. I go around Lebanon, this country, giving book signings. I give lectures. I give speeches in all the different sects and areas of Lebanon, including the most warlike areas, including Palestinian camps. And it's stunning, the experience of doing this. And I always say to them, stop asking foreigners what to do and trust the people in the next village. But all the people in Lebanon, unfortunately, including the Palestinians, they want to put their trust in the Americans, in the French, in the Iranians, in the Syrians, in the Israelis, in the British, and, you know, and I keep saying, stop asking us what to do. When the people of this region, the Middle East, not just Lebanon, trust each other and stop trusting us, you and me, I'm talking about on this radio program, there'll be peace here.
And the book you're having signed, is it The Great War for Civilization, The Conquest of the Middle East?
Yes, it is. It has a different title in Arabic. In Arabic, the title is The Great War with the Excuse of Civilization. And I'm giving you a literal translation from the Arabic. But it's correct, and it's in three volumes in Arabic. It is the same book, and I was signing it a couple of weeks ago in Nabatea, which is the Shiite heartlands, Hezbollah heartland of southern Lebanon. The French edition I've done in the Christian Maronite areas of East Beirut, and always the questions are the same. What do you as a foreigner think we should do? And each time I say, stop asking foreigners and trust yourselves. It's the only thing you can say. And I it's the same thing for this crisis now. You know, the Lebanese must solve it. They don't need new weapons from America to be airlifted on an air bridge. They don't need new rhetoric from Ahmadinejad of Iran, who I think is completely cracked. They should just trust themselves. But you see, when you've got a world of superpowers, both regional superpowers and real superpowers, and global superpowers like the United States, China, Russia, you have to do what you're told, and that is the great tragedy of the Middle East, and I suspect it's the great tragedy of the world.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles from Beirut, Robert Fisk.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking with Robert Fisk, who's a best-selling author and acclaimed journalist. He's based in Beirut, Lebanon. He writes for The Independent of London. He's lived in the region for more than three decades and is the author of this monumental 1,000-page work, The Great War for Civilization, The Conquest of the Middle East. I'm now speaking with Tyson Slocum, who's the director of Public Citizens Energy Program, and he testified just this week before the United States House Committee on Energy and Commerce, the Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations. He testified on gasoline prices, oil company profits, and the American consumer. And Tyson Slocum did, out of this testimony, there's this new anti-gouging legislation that's emerged from the House. But I understand that this has already been shot down in the Senate, a previous incarnation of it. And if this bill proceeds, the president will veto it.
That's right. This legislation actually has been vastly watered down from its original state. Originally, the anti-price gouging language was to be in effect at all times, and the sponsor of the bill, Representative Bart Stupak, made huge concessions, and now the language would only come into effect when the President of the United States declares a national emergency, which only happens occasionally, for example, after Hurricane Katrina or some sort of devastating event like that. So it's basically a toothless bill because it would not be in effect long enough to really protect people from the kind of predatory practices that large oil companies are currently engaging in.
And let's just go through these because, Exxon Mobil had a big ad in the op-ed page in the New York Times, you know, talking about price controls, which is how they've conflated the idea of anti-gouging. But let's go through the evidence, because I know the Secretary of State here in California, the Attorney General, Jerry Brown, is looking into gaming, because here in California, we experienced the gaming of the electricity market, where $30 billion was stolen from the state by outside predatory generators under legislation crafted by Enron. Forgive us for being a little gun shy out here in California. But what do you know, and what can you prove?
Well, as I outlined in my testimony last week before the House of Representatives, oil companies engage in a number of different practices that are anti-competitive and result in manipulation. First is, they intentionally withhold capacity. The United States Federal Trade Commission has found numerous instances where companies who operate large oil refineries, where crude oil is turned into things like gasoline and jet fuel, intentionally withhold supplies until prices get higher, creating an artificial shortage that drives prices up. Remember, that's exactly what Enron employed in your state of California in 2001, where the company intentionally took power plants offline to create the blackouts that then drove the price up. And while we haven't had the equivalent of blackouts in gasoline markets, the shortages that we've seen is what's driving the higher prices. It is not unrest in Nigeria or Iraq or Saudi Arabia or Venezuela. There are not global problems with shortages of crude supplies. The shortages are all downstream in gasoline supplies, and most of the gasoline that we use here in America is refined here in America, and the oil industry, ExxonMobil, Chevron, Texaco, all the big oil companies, they control 100% of that, and they are engaging in blatant activities to intentionally drive the prices up. The second big thing that the oil companies are doing is on the futures exchanges. There have been at least two companies, Marathon Oil and BP, who have been fingered by federal authorities for manipulating crude oil and gasoline prices on the futures markets. So there are a number of ways that oil companies are price gouging Americans. And, you know, Public Citizen would like to see stronger regulations over the oil companies because, you know, it would make some sense if folks paid a high price for energy, but we were getting something in return. You know, in Europe, people pay a heck of a lot more than we do for gasoline and other energy products, and it's in the form of higher taxes, and those taxes finance alternatives for folks, like mass transit and things like that. Here in America, the higher prices that we're paying are simply going to oil company profits. And that's not helping us fully fund alternative fuels or energy efficiency or mass transit. It is simply a massive transfer of wealth to oil companies and their shareholders. That's not going to help America get the sustainable energy policy that we need.
And in your testimony, you pointed out that since President George W. Bush came into the White House, the six largest oil companies operating in the United States, ExxonMobil, Chevron, Texaco, ConocoPhillips, BP, Shell, and Valero, recorded $477 billion in profits. And they also, ExxonMobil, for example, has spent $37.2 billion buying back its stock and paying dividends, and it's spent only $3.3 billion on capital investment in the United States. So,
yeah, I mean, that's...
So what's the racket here in terms of refining? Because I know Shell tried to unload a refinery here in Bakersfield, and there was a big backlash. So the oil companies are getting out of the refining business, aren't they?
Well, in some cases they are, but for the most part, they are sitting on those facilities. They often, when people say, oh, we haven't built a new refinery in 25 years, and they say, oh, it's because of the environmental laws, that's phony. I mean, remember, Jeff Skilling and Ken Lay blamed California's environmental laws for the blackouts you were having and for the high prices. Environmental laws are always the big lie that energy companies blame whenever there are price spikes. The fact is that America's public health laws are not impeding investment in refineries or other energy infrastructure. It is intentional decisions by energy companies. The ExxonMobil has, I've read through their statements to Wall Street, they're not going to build a new refinery, not because of America's sensible public health laws, but because it's not in their financial self-interest to do so. Because building new refineries or vastly expanding current capacity would create surplus capacity. A surplus, of course, would drive prices down, and if prices go down, their profits go down.
So this is a convenient bottleneck.
Absolutely. It's an intentional bottleneck. And so The more we understand about the reasons for the bottlenecks, we can better craft policy to address it. And all we've been hearing from the oil industry is the bottlenecks are because of environmental laws. So their solution and the Bush administration's solution has been, let's gut environmental laws. That's the worst thing we can do. The best thing to do is to hold the oil industry accountable, get rid of the billions of dollars in subsidies that we, the taxpayer, give them each year, maybe even enact a windfall profits tax. Let's have America's most profitable industry help finance our transition to a sustainable energy future. That's what we need right now, is more funding for mass transit, for energy efficiency, for research and development of alternative fuels. The oil companies aren't doing it. They're not getting the job done. It's the job of government to take the lead on this, and we think the oil industry ought to play a role in financing that.
Well, it's clear that the oil companies and the suppliers, for that matter, the Saudis and others have manipulated the market. And in fact, the investigative journalist Bob Woodward, in his two last books, pointed out that the Bush family managed to get their friends, the Al Sauds in Saudi Arabia, to pump a lot more oil, and presumably the oil companies obliged in terms of refining to make more supply available prior to the 04, the 02, the 04, and the 06 election here in the United States.
Oh, yeah, no question.
Because you noticed that the gas prices went down before all of those elections. And the minute the elections were over, they went back up again.
You're absolutely right. And that played a very big role in California, because there was a ballot initiative. I think it was Proposition 87, correct?
Right.
That would have enacted a big royalty production tax on oil companies. And that would have been dedicated to funding the kinds of renewable energy and alternative fuel projects that we need. And there is no question that, in addition to, of course, the political lobbying and TV ads that the oil industry was doing, but the fact that prices went down took a lot of the immediacy and the anger away from the voters, and so the voters weren't upset about the issue and didn't come out and vote as strongly as they would have. But the oil industry clearly has its partisan favorites. I mean, since the year 2000, the five largest oil companies have made $105 million in campaign contributions. 80% of that has gone to Republicans. So it's a very partisan industry. They have done a big job financing elections. And there's no question that they hold a lot of sway in the Bush-Cheney administration. Remember, Dick Cheney was in charge of energy policy back in 2001 when he chaired that energy task force. And we know that he secretly met with all the top CEOs and their lobbyists. They crafted energy policy. And now we've seen what a Cheney energy policy looks like. It looks like much higher prices, bigger reliance on imports, bigger reliance on coal and oil for our energy. We're using less renewable energy than when Bush came into office. We're importing more oil and prices are higher. That's not a sustainable energy policy. That's not an energy policy that works for working people. That's an energy policy that's written by and for big oil.
Well, your conclusion in your testimony to the Congress says, this era of high energy prices and record oil company profits isn't a simple case of supply and demand, as the evidence indicates that consolidation of energy infrastructure assets combined with weak and non-existent regulatory oversight on energy trading markets provides opportunity for energy companies and financial institutions to price gouge Americans, forcing consumers suffering from inelastic demand to continue to pay high prices, in part fueled by uncompetitive actions. Not only hurts consumers economically, but environmentally as well, as the oil companies and energy traders enjoy record profits, are not at the same time are not investing those earnings into sustainable energy alternatives to our addiction to oil. As a result, our consumption of fossil fuel continues to grow, and the impact of global warming takes its toll on our environment. So I'm summing up there for you, Tyson, but I thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, it was my pleasure.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking then with Tyson Slocum, who's with Public Citizen in Washington, D.C. He's the director of Public Citizen's Energy Program, and he testified to the Congress this week. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer. I thank Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, Elliot Fong, the assistant producer, and Melissa Figueroa, the engineer.